and welcome to Science World.
Well, this is the first time that we've ever observed lava coils on any extraterrestrial surface, or Mars in particular. They really are a spectacular pattern when you look at the images. Just looking at it, you can tell that this is something new.
We talked with the Arizona State University graduate student who recently discovered a new form of solidified lava flows on Mars. India successfully launches an all-weather surveillance satellite, and the company announces their plans to mine for precious metals on asteroids. We have these stories and more coming up for you on VOA Science Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. India has successfully launched a satellite that may dramatically boost that country's ability to view detailed images of the Earth. Kurt Asian reports from New Delhi.
Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh congratulated Indian aerospace engineers Thursday after a rocket successfully lifted an advanced imaging satellite weighing nearly 2,000 kilograms into orbit. K. Radhakrishnan, chairman of the Indian Space Research Organization, describes the launch as a victory for India.
Our initial data shows we have achieved an orbit with 470 to 480 kilometers.
The satellite is called RESAT-1, which stands for Radar Imaging Satellite. Unlike previous imaging satellites launched by India, which collect a picture of the ground using optical cameras, RESAT-1 bounces microwave signals off the Earth. Dr. Ajay Lele, a researcher at New Delhi's Institute for Defense Studies and Analyses, says the satellite sensor will be able to obtain clear images no matter what is happening below.
This sensor gives you an opportunity to see towards the Earth in all sorts of weather conditions, and night time and morning time and daytime hardly has got any impact as far as the sensor is concerned.
Such all-weather capability is significant in India, which experiences an annual monsoon season during which heavy cloud cover can impair the usefulness of optical satellite imagery. P.K. Alex is a director at the Indian Space Research Organization.
Previously, we used to have only the cloud picture, just an image alone. This gives additional parameters. All will be used for our weather forecast from the coming years.
In addition to images, RESAT-1 is capable of gathering data on cloud temperature, cloud speed, and the level of air humidity. Lele, with the Institute for Defense Studies, says the satellite will serve various uses for the Indian government.
It has got relevance for climate change, disaster management, flood relief, agriculture too. It will have a certain amount of a relevance in strategic sector too, because it will allow to monitor the troop movements or infiltrations, terrorist organizations which are operating from deeply forested areas and other stuff.
RESAT-1 has an expected mission life of 5 years, making 14 orbits a day. The launch is likely to create economic benefits for India, generating interest among other nations who seek data or technological assistance, or to commission India to launch a satellite on their behalf. Kurt Asian, VOA News, New Delhi.
Some 300 million people living in Africa lack access to safe and reliable sources of water. But what if they've been sitting all along on a huge reservoir of groundwater that could provide water for both drinking and agriculture? A new study by scientists with the British Geological Survey suggests that underground, there may be more than 100 times the annual renewable freshwater resource available in Africa, and 20 times that stored in freshwater lakes. The countries where groundwater is most plentiful include Libya, Algeria, Egypt, and Sudan. A dairy cow in California was recently found to have mad cow disease. Experts say the infected cow poses no risk to the public or other animals. Steve Barragona has more.
The case of mad cow disease is the fourth detected in the United States since 2003. The cattle illness is caused by a faulty protein in the animal's brain or central nervous system. Eating tissues infected with the protein is believed to be responsible for a rare human form of the disease. Most of the 224 cases worldwide are linked to an outbreak in cattle in the United Kingdom in the 1990s. But since then, the European Union and the United States have tightened regulations to prevent another outbreak, according to Ron DeHaven, head of the American Veterinary Medical Association.
Even if an infected cow were to go to slaughter, the tissues that represent a food safety risk never make it into the human food chain.
Tissues at risk of infection, including brains and spinal cords, are also no longer permitted in animal feed, which is how the UK outbreak is believed to have spread. This case is not linked to animal feed. It appears to have happened spontaneously, according to Cornell University veterinarian Martin Weidman.
And that happens every now and then. We don't know why.
Weidman says the fact that regulators caught this cow before slaughter shows the safety system is working. His one piece of advice?
Make sure you cook your hamburger well, and that has nothing to do with mad cow disease.
He says it is just a good idea to keep your food safe. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Health authorities, led by the World Health Organization, are making progress against drug-resistant strains of malaria in the border regions of Thailand. But as Ron Corbin reports, WHO officials say efforts to curb the emergence of drug-resistant malaria in Burma are critical to preventing the disease from spreading into South Asia.
World Health Organization, WHO, says malaria threatens 2.2 billion people in 20 countries across the Asia-Pacific region. In 2010, there were 28 million cases reported and 38,000 lives lost, a death toll exceeded only in sub-Saharan Africa. More than 90% of the deaths were in India, Burma, Bangladesh, Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. Worldwide, the mosquito-borne disease affects some 260 million people and kills around 650,000 of them every year. In recent years, health authorities have come to rely on a combination of therapies based on the artemisinin drug for treating malaria. Dr. Pascal Ringwald, coordinator of WHO's Drug Resistance and Containment Unit, says progress has been made in the Mekong region, especially in treating cases involving the deadly parasite falciparum, but he says the gains remain fragile.
Paradoxically, and this is a good news, the number of falciparum cases is going down, drastically down, and this is due not only to the containment activities, but it also because we have better tools, we have now combination therapy, and the country had better malaria control activities. So the number of cases of malaria is going down in the different countries.
WHO health authorities are moving to a stage of completely eliminating malaria in Bhutan, North Korea, Nepal and Sri Lanka. Deaths from the disease have declined markedly in Bangladesh and Thailand, and gains are being recorded in India, Indonesia, Burma and East Timor. But an emerging threat has come with the growing incidence of drug-resistant malaria strains, especially in Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam and Burma. Ringwald says the challenge is to maintain a political commitment to the fight against malaria.
One of the problems is that when countries are progressively reducing the malaria burden, malaria is not more a priority. So we need in areas where artemisinin resistance has emerged, most often the transmission of the malaria is very low. And what we need to keep is awareness and political commitment that malaria is not a neglected disease.
Drug-resistant forms of malaria have emerged in border regions of Thailand and Cambodia, and between Thailand and Burma. Scientists blame the use of single-use drugs and sales of fake drugs for the resistance. WHO says Cambodia is making efforts to crack down on the sales of fake drugs. WHO says the main concern lies in Burma, where 40 million people, or 69% of the population, live in malaria-endemic areas. In 2010, Burma officially reported 650,000 malaria cases and 788 fatalities, though drug combinations are effective in more than 95% of the country's cases. WHO is watching closely for any sign of the drug-resistant strains spreading into South Asia, and Ringwald says the goal is to contain the strains in the areas where they now exist. Ringwald says Africa also needs to strengthen its malaria control to avoid the emergence of the same kinds of strains now evident in Southeast Asia. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Antiretroviral drugs used to treat HIV may also be able to prevent infection in the first place. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP for short. Now California is launching new studies to determine PrEP's effectiveness beyond clinical trials and out in the real world. Joe DiCapua reports.
Treatment as prevention has been shown to be highly successful in clinical trials. But will it work for people in high-risk groups as they go about their daily lives? Will they adhere to the drug regimen even if it's taking only one pill a day? These are some of the questions the California HIV/AIDS Research Program hopes to answer with three new studies. Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy group AVAC, says these are demonstration studies.
So these are not randomized controlled trials where we're telling people you may get placebo, you may get the active drug, and even if you get the active drug, we don't know if it works. These are studies that are going to work with people in communities in California. People who are at risk are going to be explained that we think this product works based on these clinical trials, but only if you use them, and provide it to a small number of people to really better understand the safety and effectiveness in areas outside of clinical trials.
The studies focus on groups where HIV infections are rising rapidly.
All of these activities in California are focused on men who have sex with men and transgender women. And that is entirely understandable and appropriate given the epidemic in the United States. That is the leading area of need. At the same time, we really hope as advocates that these demonstration projects in California are the first of many and that many more will look at other populations.
Those taking part in the study are being asked to follow what would appear to be a very simple drug regimen.
It is a daily dose, and it is a combined drug. It's a single pill, but with both active tenofovir and emtricitabine, and it is the same dose that is provided to people who are infected with HIV who use the same pill for treatment. So the recommendation that was studied in the trial was the same single pill every day.
However, Warren says pre-exposure prophylaxis is only effective if people take the pill. So the studies will also examine why people may skip doses, even if they only have to swallow one pill a day.
People who took this pill consistently had high levels, in excess of 70% reduction of risk. People who didn't take the pill consistently didn't get any benefit at all. There was no added protection.
When antiretrovirals first came on the scene in the early and mid-90s, people had to take dozens of pills a day. They had to take them at very specific times, sometimes with food, sometimes without. They often had very bad side effects, including nausea. There were even conditions called buffalo hump and Crick's belly, where body fat would build up behind the neck or on the abdomen. So while lives were being saved, treatment could make people feel pretty sick. Warren says it's much different today.
We also have to remember the incredible scientific advances from the 80s when getting HIV inevitably meant a very short life and a very painful disease and death to a period of early antiretroviral therapy where we had drugs that were very difficult to take and very toxic, but they could save your life if you could withstand that, to a point now where people can take one or two pills a day, much safer, much less toxic. We're in a very different place.
In May, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration will review the PrEP research. It could lead to greater access to prevention as treatment and provide accurate information to healthcare providers, insurance companies, and potential users. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The launch of the first privately built and operated spaceship to the International Space Station has been postponed. California-based Space Exploration Technologies, better known as SpaceX, moved the launch date from Monday, April 30th to May 7th. Officials said engineers need more time to complete pre-launch tests. SpaceX will launch the unmanned reusable Dragon capsule from Florida's Cape Canaveral Air Force Station on a mission to deliver over 500 kilograms of cargo to the space station and its six-member crew. A company called Planetary Resources says it plans to mine asteroids for raw materials, ranging from water to precious metals. Suzanne Presto has more.
Planetary Resources co-founder, Peter Diamandis, is an entrepreneur, best-selling author, medical doctor, and CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation. Speaking at a news conference at the Museum of Flight in Seattle, Washington, Diamandis said he has wanted to be an asteroid miner since he was a teenager.
The vision of Planetary Resources is to make the resources of space available to humanity both in space and here on Earth. Whether it's propellant from water on asteroids or strategic metals and minerals that are important to promoting and creating a world of abundance here on Earth.
Company officials say resource extraction from asteroids will grow to be valued at tens of billions of dollars annually, but they stress that that kind of payday is decades away. They add that asteroid mining will provide a sustainable supply of precious metals to Earth's growing population. Along with Diamandis, Eric Anderson is the co-founder and co-chairman of Planetary Resources. While precious metals such as platinum would be welcome, Anderson says they also want to mine for elements found in abundance here on Earth, namely hydrogen and oxygen, which are the basis for water, and rocket fuel.
If we're able to successfully deploy and mine for water, we're going to create a network of propellant depots, of gas stations that literally open up the roadways to the rest of the solar system. So it's going to drastically reduce the cost of deep space exploration.
Planetary Resources says it has developed the first line in a family of deep space prospecting spacecraft, the ARCID 100 series. The craft is essentially a space telescope that will help scientists identify and prioritize near-Earth asteroid targets. The company says this spacecraft will be launched in about 2 years. Beyond that, officials said the plan is to mass-produce follow-on ARCID 300 series spacecraft and send them off in swarms on expeditions. Planetary Resources says its mining would be done robotically. Officials say they hope to identify asteroids to prospect within the decade. The company's financial backers include billionaires such as Google CEO Larry Page and Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt. Planetary Resources counts famed film director and deep-sea explorer James Cameron as a project advisor, but some news reports have identified him as a financial backer. Cameron told VOA that his involvement in this project has been overstated in media reports.
I'm not an investor in that. I'm on the advisory board because I'm interested in lots of projects with respect to entrepreneurial space as well as space science and research.
Cameron, who is visiting China for the Beijing International Film Festival, told VOA's Beijing bureau chief that as he left a party a few days ago, he was asked if he would be on the advisory board. He said he answered sure as he walked out the door, and that is the sum total of his involvement to date. Still, Cameron says, mining asteroids is a great idea.
We're going to be a resource-depleted planet that's going to be voracious for metals and rare earth minerals and things like that, which we can harvest from within the solar system. And there's logic to getting them from asteroids because you don't have to lift them out of a gravity well. Like you know, mining on Mars doesn't make sense. Mining on the moon makes very little sense because you've got to lift everything out of a gravity well to get it to Earth. But anyway, that's something that I'm only a tiny part of.
Officials at Planetary Resources say near-Earth asteroids could be reached with little propulsion, and it would be relatively easy to depart from them because of their very small gravity fields. They also say that private industry can take more risks, work at a faster pace, and tolerate high-cost failures in a way that governments cannot. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Looking at Mars, Arizona State University graduate student Andrew Ryan recently discovered some new and unique patterns in solidified lava flows on that planet's surface. In a paper published by the journal Science, Ryan described the patterns as looking like a snail shell. Ryan said that lava flow patterns such as these have been found on Earth, but never before on Mars. I recently spoke with Andy Ryan about his discovery and the research and study he conducted to back up his findings. He joins us for this week's edition of our one-on-one segment. Andy, what exactly did you discover?
They are large spiral patterns on the surface of some volcanic features on Mars. We believe that they are lava coils, like lava coils that you would find on the surface of Hawaiian volcanic flows.
Why is it considered to be a new form of lava flow?
Well, this is the first time that we've ever observed lava coils on any extraterrestrial surface, or Mars in particular. They really are a spectacular pattern when you look at the images. Just looking at it, you can tell that this is something new. And they are also indicative of flow patterns that are occurring in the area because they form in zones of shear stress. It's where parts of the flow are moving past each other at different speeds or even in different directions.
Andy, you mentioned something I'm curious about. What's a shear stress?
A shear stress is kind of like if you were to rub your hands together, you're creating a shear stress between your hands. And so a shear stress is what's causing the plastic sort of rubbery crust on the top of a lava flow or a lava lake to twist around. So it's in these zones of shear that this lava crust is coiling around or it's being wrinkled around.
Andy, can you tell us about the coils of lava flow you did find on Mars? How large are they and what do they look like?
They look like a spiral pattern, kind of like what you would see on a Nautilus shell or even in the cloud patterns on some of the gas giants like Jupiter sometimes. They range in size from down to about a meter across because that's about as small as we can see using the high-rise camera images that are taken on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that's circling Mars. So the smallest are about a meter, and the largest one is about 30 meters across. Really quite large, a spectacular find, quite a bit larger than the lava coils we're used to seeing on Earth as well.
Andy, what kind of insight do you think your finding will provide regarding our knowledge about Mars?
It's possible once we've done some numerical modeling of these lava coils that we can learn a bit about the composition of the lava from which they formed. I intend to do further research where we might be able to figure out the viscosity of the lava while it was solidifying and these coils were forming. Now, viscosity is just a fancy way of saying how thick was the lava. So something that is highly viscous is something like maple syrup, whereas water has a low viscosity. And so the viscosity of the lava can tell us about maybe its temperature and possibly even its composition. And once we've learned about lavas that are erupting onto the surface, the lava comes from within Mars. So we're seeing basically bits of the Martian mantle.
Now, I know that you made your observations, your findings from examining probably countless images from the Mars Explorer satellite. Is there any way from examining those images that you can get an idea of when these coils were formed?
Yes. Several researchers have made estimates of the age of the area where we found these coils. They're present in an area known as Athabasca Vallis, and more specifically in a large basin called Cerberus Pallas. And researchers can estimate the age of planetary surfaces by the number of craters that are on them. And the more craters you have, the older the surface is, just because it's been there longer, more craters. There have been more time for impactors to make craters. So Athabasca Vallis has very few impact craters, which suggests that it's probably a very young surface. There have been estimates ranging anywhere from 2 million to 200 million years, which may sound like a long time ago, but in geologic terms, that's actually a very short time ago. Mars itself is 4.5 billion years old, so 2 or even 50 million years is practically yesterday in geologic history.
And finally, Andy, what kind of feedback and response have you been getting on this finding?
It's received a lot of attention so far from my colleagues and classmates just because it's a really interesting-looking feature. The image itself that I first identified the lava coils in, it contains about 170 lava coils in one image alone. And so you can just scan the image, and they're everywhere. The area is peppered with them. The researchers who have studied the area in detail, some of the people who have published papers talking about the volcanic history in this area, I think that they're enthusiastic about this find because it really is just sort of another nail in the coffin stating that, yes, this is a volcanic province, not an ice-related province. And it just shows that we're on the right track with how we're understanding Mars.
That was Andrew Ryan from Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. So stop by and visit us on the Internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Fantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.